I don't think I'm going to say anything that runs directly contrary to anything we've heard, which might suggest to you that it's contentless, but no. just taking a slightly different path, picking up on thoughts about potentiality and actuality, and bringing in teleology to help discipline that thought a little bit. Okay, it's really easy for Thomas to talk about potency and actuality. We all know that we individuate potencies by actualities. We all know that the kind of changes Thomist Neo-Aristotelians love to discuss are changes from potency to act, and we all know that there are active and passive potencies that correspond roughly to changers and what's changed in any change. And we have a kind of glib and easy way with this language. To put it mildly, I developed a stutter around this easy language, and it was a major stutter. And I am the sort of person whose stutters can be the intellectual equivalent of like an existential crisis, okay? I mean, I'm not proud of it, but it's true. So, in the very last conversation that I had with Father Lawrence Dewan, he actually quieted the deep anxiety and helped me get rid of the stutter in connection with how we might cope with passive potency by saying two sentences with a long pause in between them, and then telling me a story about soldiers finding a way of using soda pop bottles and barbed wire and bits of wood to send radio signals in World War II. The two things that he said were, one, and I have to do Father Dewan saying this, a potency is supposed to be a power. Both fists. And then, after a long pause, human beings see possibilities. Okay, now, there are certain moments when teaching coincides with pastoral care. This was one of them, for which I was profoundly grateful. My aim in this talk will be to unpack the teaching that I took from the two sentences. And I'm going to do so by beginning thinking about Aristotle. Okay. Now, I confess that I am not among those students of Aquinas who think that Aquinas just is Aristotle. And some of my best friends would say this, in the biz, would say this. At least I have never developed a sense of Aristotle as a profound theologian and have never failed to be struck by St. Thomas in this respect. Now, Aquinas, of course, found resources for very profound theological reflection in Aristotle. He's better at that than I ever will be. But where physics and the special science and metaphysics are concerned, contemporary Aristotle scholars are more likely than we are to ask the kinds of questions that, if unanswered, will keep this reader of Aquinas up at night and send somebody shy chasing after Father Dewan, who's a giant, of course. All right. Like readers of Aquinas, they disagree. And where questions about potency and act are concerned, the disagreement is often fierce. Most do not read St. Thomas. We cannot avoid reading at least the slightly marred Aristotle available in the Latin with which Aquinas was working, since our man's commentaries on their man are crucial to understanding our man. I will trace a path through Aristotle scholarship that strikes me as a path in the same neighborhood as Aquinas' path. There are differences. Okay. I admit it. And it's not that they're... my chosen readers of Aristotle take it that Aristotle is much less generous about calling a body a substance than Aquinas was. For example, mixed things, even those mixed things whose ingredients could not be recovered from the mixture after the mixing, will not always count as substances for this Aristotle. Further, on the strict readings that I have come to love, substances are countable kinds of bodies, so some bodies don't count as substances. The elements, for instance, count as bodies that are not substances on at least some of these readings. Now, there are serious reasons for these boundaries on treating bodies as substances in Aristotle. And there are serious reasons that Aquinas redraws the map a little. Right? Just different reasons, different interests. Happily, our man was as aware as anyone of the centrality of substance to Aristotle's physics and metaphysics. I'm going to have to traffic in substance a little. It's unavoidable when reading Aristotle's Book 9 of Aristotle's Metaphysics. The point is to find a clear way of saying what I think I got from Father Dorn. Okay. Starting from a potency is supposed to be a power. Metaphysics 9 follows Aristotle's lengthy and detailed treatment of substance as a primary, mode of being. We've been hearing a lot about that. Substance is not said of and not present in anything else, hence cannot be accidental, whereas all accidents are accidents of substances, and so on. The metaphysics takes a turn in Book 9, which begins by pointing out that being also can be treated in terms of potency and actuality. Aristotle's investigation of potency and actuality is devoted to and structured around introducing, distinguishing, and connecting various senses of the term dunamis. There is tremendous scholarly controversy about the goals of this treatise and about its place in the metaphysics and about how to understand the different senses of dunamis at issue in it. Dunamis, in the most ordinary translation, which would, of course, please Father Dewan, refers to strength or power or ability, and it is sometimes, frequently actually, translated as capacity. Aristotle begins by exploring the common sense of the term and tells us that this usual way is not the way that will be most useful for his purposes. Okay, for Aristotle and, of course, Aquinas, the usual sense is the sense at issue in talk about a process. And processes are individuated by their ends. The useful sense for Book 9 is a special sort of process on the kind of unusual reading that I'm going to recommend. The unusual reading differs from the dominant or standard contemporary interpretation of the useful sense as opposed to the more usual sense. According to this interpretation, the common usage picks out a capacity for change in the sense kinesis or process. And on the dominant interpretation, we use potency now for this. Okay. But the useful sense is better understood as pointing to a particular kind of activity, an energeia, rather than a kinesis. And the dominant way of handling this nowadays is to treat that as what a potentiality is. Now, an energeia activity, rather than a kinesis, has three different features that aren't shared in a kinesis. First, an energeia is indefinitely extendable. Second, an energeia is complete at every moment of its actualization. And third, an energeia does not involve a product independent of its realization. So the standard examples of energeia are things like seeing. If I'm seeing, at any moment I'm seeing, I already have seeing. The actualization of that power is nothing distinct from the seeing itself, and so on. Okay. Now, so for the standard reading, there's these two very different understandings of dunamis at issue. The useful one is linked to energeia. The usual one is linked to kinesis or process. And the energeia sense is supposed to expand in a particular way to cover anything that would properly be called a potentiality, which is a term that has a little more like modal and ontological weight as mode of being or something than potency does for these guys. Andreas Anagnostopoulos, I'm not used to reading it, describes the situation this way, quote, "Recently scholars have almost uniformly identified this useful sense of dunamis as that employed in talk about potentiality rather than mere capacity or potency, including the usual sense of dunamis as kinesis-like capacity for change." And this forms the starting point for their interpretation of the treatise. According to this dominant interpretation, Aristotle's central innovation is manifest in the thought, for example, that a pile of bricks not only has a capacity to become a house, but also is a house in a certain way, namely, potentially, it is a potential house. Close quote. Accordingly, on the dominant interpretation, capacity for change rises to the level of a mode of being in a shift from what one might call a plain potency to what should instead be marked by this term potentiality, a proper mode of being rather than just a being's capacity for change. Now, by means of, trust me, I'll give you the reference if you want to check it up, painstaking examination of the Greek and strong argumentative challenges, Anagnostopoulos takes down the dominant interpretation, construction by construction, sentence by sentence, and point by point, finding a strict commonality underlying the analogy between the process sense of dunamis and the useful sense. The strict commonality turns on an active principle of change, an understanding of dunamis that on this reading is shared across all the different capacities or potencies discussed in the treatise. Happily, as near as I can tell, Anagnostopoulos is often on the side of the angelic doctor in his reading of Book 9 of the Metaphysics. They share the view that the usual sense of our disputed term refers to an active principle of change, and an active principle of change is a source of change in some other being, so insofar as it is other, even though not all capacities at issue in the treatise are happily treated as capacities to change or to be changed. The capacity to resist change is also counted as a dunamis in 9.1, 1046a, 13 to 14. Moreover, some changes, Aristotle insists, do not involve active or passive potencies. Harry Ide puts the point this way, quote, "First, Aristotle claims that one way for something to be is to be potentially dunamai, And so investigation of what it is to be must include being potentially. Second, and more important, Aristotle explains how form and matter together make a unified being by saying that form is actually the thing and matter is potentially the thing. But in some cases, something becomes F even though it is not potentially F. For example, water becomes wine even though it is not potentially wine. And a human being becomes dead even though a human being is not potentially dead. That's in Metaphysics 8.5. So Aristotle's account of potentiality must allow that some changes occur without potentiality. End quote. One of the ways in which a potency is a power is partly this. Not every change involves the actualization of a potency for Aristotle. The subject undergoing change need not properly be characterized as having the passive potency to be changed in the relevant way. Further, not every actualization of a potency involves a product external to the process that actualizes the potency. So we have changes without powers, and powers, the exercise or activation of which does not involve kinesis-style change. How then are you supposed to isolate and understand potencies? This is where the stammer started. Okay, I found it helpful at this point to actually go back to Aristotle's Physics. Part of the task of that earlier work is to argue for the reality of change against philosophers who found change so inexplicably baffling that they either denied the reality of change or else made change so pervasive that it became hard to isolate and characterize a changed or changing thing. On the reading I'll favor, the two sorts of change most important for Aristotle in the Physics are natural changes and purposeful changes. Understanding natural change rests on an understanding of substances as having internal principles of change. Living substances as being the sources of the changes that tend to their growth, maintenance, and reproduction. Inanimate substances as being by nature susceptible of some kinds of change and resistant to other kinds of change. As I've mentioned, not all material things count as substances. On this reading of Aristotle, artifacts don't count, and for some of the scholars, the elements don't count. But although all organisms are bodies, it is not as material things that organisms are counting as substances on this reading. As nearly every modern person who pauses to think about such matters while reading Aristotle has probably noticed, a science that turns on properties of body as such, properties like mass, velocity, position, duration, and the like, is based on categories other than substance. A single Aristotelian substance could change with respect to any combination of these without expressing or altering its nature as a substance. Okay. Suppose, as I think is true, that stones are substances for Aristotle, and they certainly are for Aquinas as well. A stone falling on an account based on these properties of bodies as such is not an instance of the stone expressing its substantial nature. It is, in the relevant senses, no different from an account of a person falling off a tall building. Since falling is, perhaps, the most characteristic thing that a stone qua substance does, if its nature as a substance is irrelevant to an explanation of its falling, then it is hard to see that there is any room in such a science for specific substantial nature to be doing a lot of the explanatory work. What does specific substantial nature add to an understanding of change? In particular, how does treatment of substantial nature help to show the sense in which a potency is a power? In her discussion of the physics, after treating the three actualities at issue in change, the actual change, the actual subject of change, and the actual result or product of change, Sarah Waterlow, and this is before she was Brody, has this to offer. Quote, Aristotle typifies process and change as incomplete actuality. He does not mean that they are not fully real, but that they are really incomplete. This, he says, is, quote, because the subject of whose potentiality is the actual exercise, this is the change is the actual exercise, is incomplete, close quote. We might object that the subject's negative condition does not necessarily render it incomplete. For complete here can hardly be understood except evaluatively. But positive properties acquired through change may not enhance or fulfill the subject. Sometimes they are neutral. Sometimes they are damaging. Thus, this formula can only be guaranteed to cover natural and purposed changes to states valuable or proper or life-enhancing for the subject. But there's little point in amending him on this, for his entire analysis is molded so as to fit not change as such, but natural and purposed change. Close quote. Structuring the entire account of change with an eye toward explaining those changes that result in new states that are, quote, valuable or proper or life-enhancing, close quote, for the subject of change, writes teleology into the basic structure of Aristotle's account of change, and thereby into his account of potency. That is why, although I will one day die, I am not potentially a corpse. I'm not potentially a corpse. Sorry. And although I could be pushed or thrown from the top of a tall building, I am not potentially broken in whatever way such an event might break me. In general, in cases where actual change occurs to a substance without that substance having a potentiality to be changed in the relevant way, the change damages the substance or is neutral with respect to the substance's specific nature on this way of reading Aristotle. Such change is not happily modeled as the actuation of potency. I take it that this is a significant aspect of Father Dewan's insistence that potentiality is meant to be a power. It is why, even though I am, in fact, actually, a carrier of Tay-Sachs disease, it would be wrong to credit me with having the potentiality or power to transmit Tay-Sachs to my offspring, and wrong to credit any child that I might be blessed to carry with having the power or potentiality to be so afflicted. The stone falls, the flower blooms, the fruit ripens, the toddler learns to walk or speak. These are actual changes expressive of the natures of the substances at issue, and so express corresponding active and passive potentialities. For Aristotle, on the readings that seem to me to accord with Aquinas's reading, and certainly with Dewan's Aquinas, for what that's worth, one, the many and varied changes of a particular natural object are best described in a way that brings out the common structure or pattern that expresses the object's nature. This works for primary substances. It works for the simple bodies like fire. Potencies whose actualization expresses the natures of the objects whose powers are an issue, those are the kinds that work as powers, I think. On this way of thinking about potency and actuality, even passive potencies are referred to natures. If that's how you distribute them around in your metaphysics, you're always picking up on substantial nature. Okay? All right. This brings me to the second sentence. Human beings see possibilities. Now, the fact that we can do something to an object does not mean that the object had the passive potency to be what we made of it before we got busy. Okay. And in Aristotle, it's pretty clear. It's like in the building that you start getting discussions of the construction materials as having the potentiality to be the thing that's about to be built. But it's in the building. It's like they're getting worked up. They're getting used. That sort of stuff. Okay. A pile of bricks is not a potential house or pizza oven or anything else that we might make of the bricks before we get taken interest in those bricks and engage with those bricks as building materials. In building with them, right, we make it the case that the bricks are the stuff for house building or making a pizza oven or something like that. If we need to work up the materials we use in building or baking or mixing or making in order to make those materials apt to take the form we seek, it is misleading, on this way of reading Aristotle at least, to treat these materials as being potentially what we will make of them well before we start using them. Things have potencies by nature, by practice, by learning, or by the hand of agents or the operation of agents who are working them up for use. The story about the resourceful soldiers was partly meant to show the error in supposing that barbed wire strung on a fence plus, elsewhere on the battleground, some pieces of wood, plus, elsewhere, some soda pop bottles. You could imagine a heap. It's a virtual heap, but you're imagining a heap. Is potentially a radio transmitter. It's the way to make sense, right? And this was enough to quiet my mind and settle my spirit. Thank you.
So I'm intrigued by aside from how you would actually make a radio transmitter out of those materials. I don't know.
Father Duan was great on this.
I guess I'd just like to hear you go into a little more detail on this human seed potentials everywhere.
That's the point. One of the points is that potentiality is not coextensive with tendency or possibility or any such thing, right? Those are different notions on this way of reading Aristotle, at least.
Yeah.
And at least it works for me with Aquinas. Now, if somebody's got a killer proof passage, I will take it back and say, here, I'm with Aristotle.
So would it be the case that you would apply the same possibility talk to chance interactions that don't involve human agents, where there's something which is maybe not naturally disposed or doesn't have this capacity towards a certain natural end, but then something comes and by force, you know, interacts with it and changes it in some way. Would you describe it in the same way of the possibility as opposed to the potency?
It would sort of depend on the structure of the agent with respect to the structures of the things that were about to be changed. In the natural world, obviously, coercion is not unusual.
Yeah.
things bump. If you are serious about this way of reading Aristotle, at least, each of those natures counts as a kind of an achievement. And those natures are such that they are susceptible to some kinds of change and resistant to other kinds of change. And if you're appealing to those aspects in giving your explanation of these violent clashing interactions, then yeah, I'm happy to say that what you've got are, I mean, you know, you're not going to make gloves out of water. You're not, you know, it's that there's all those things hold. And that, I think, is going to, on this way of at least this way of reading Aristotle in a way that continues from the physics to the metaphysics, that's what you would say. Okay, I don't know who's up first. Father James.
Thank you. I guess this is with the potency question. I see the point of the radio transmitter. I guess I'm wondering, I'm just not terribly familiar with passive potency in this way. And text on it. So I guess you would say there is some sort of more proximate passive potency for like bricks or barbed wire that they have. Like you could think of, for example, rocks have a potentiality of some sort to like take different configurations or something like that. Like they could be cracked or they could be carved into them. It doesn't seem like a particular carving is a potentiality that they have, but it seems to me like there is a natural sense in which they have a passive potency to be carved or to be cracked, or I don't know how you would talk about that. Is that a passive potency?
I actually think it's very hard to individuate passive potencies. I mean, and the easiest and cleanest way to do it is through a characterization of whatever you're going to call the agent of the change and whatever you're going to call the passion involved, the agent, the action and passion involved, and then the changer and changed involved in terms of their natures. I think it would be, it's okay to suppose that the rock is such that it will shatter under certain conditions. Right, it can't resist that kind of change. Just like the wood is such that it can get burned up by the fire, not just ignited, but burned up by the fire, right? But you're relying there on the nature of wood and the nature of fire and the way that these things work, operate together in this kind of sense. Now that's, Dewan was actually pretty resistant to supposing, I mean, he was, as I heard him, the thing that made me feel calm inside, as I heard him, was that he was pretty insistent that you don't want to just go attributing passive potentiality everywhere. You've got even a common material used by human beings in a particular sort of a way, that it's going to develop that in the course of our working it up, in the way that we work it up. Now, of course, its nature has to be such that it won't resist the changes that are involved. I mean, if it's on this way of looking, and we have to be such that we can manipulate it in the relevant way. But he was really trying to work against the pile of bricks as potentially a pizza oven.
This is just as a slight follow-up. So I guess it seems to me maybe it's where you draw the line on the process. So it seems like the wood doesn't have the potential to be burned up because that's like an indefinite end of the process. But is it combustible? Is that the passive potency?
The passive potency is combustible, and then if the fire consumes it, the wood is gone. Right. the wood is gone. The passive potencies over here have to do with, you know, growth, thinking, knowledge, learning, all kinds of stuff, but not with the stuff of worms. Not with worm food. And Aristotle and Aquinas are both absolutely clear on that. Yeah.
Thank you, Doctor. So one of your motivating examples, I think, for distinguishing potentiality from possibility was that I don't have a potential to be a corpse, right?
Right.
But something in you has the potential to be a corpse, right? Namely, the signate matter, which currently partially constitutes.
It has the capacity to remain after I'm dead. That's a thing about it. It will remain after I'm dead, but it won't even be a body anymore after I'm gone.
Well, yes, we'll set aside the issue that a corpse is not actually just one thing. Let's just pretend that it is for a moment. Would you be okay saying that or the collection, just name the collection. Would you be comfortable saying that your signate matter has the potential to be that collection?
What I would want to say is that qua body, I have the capacity to fall, to be pushed, to be thrown, to corrupt, disintegrate,
right.
All these things. The qua body, that's true of me, and I am, of course, a body. That doesn't make reference to my form, right? It's not... So you wouldn't ascribe to Candace these potentialities on this way of reading it. Except you would describe, I mean, these are stuff about these kinds of organic bodies. Does that help at all?
I was just wondering if you're willing to say that your matter has the potency to be important.
This too solid flesh will melt. I'm happy with something like that. If that's enough, that's fine.
Okay, yeah.
If that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the thought that comes to my mind is that the way that you're talking about power here, it really seems to map on very nicely to the notion of appetite or inclination. I mean, I don't know that there's any real distinction between what Aquinas means by a power versus appetite or inclination, because there's an ordering, right?
Right.
And the very first division that you can make upon in terms of inclination is natural inclination. That is something that proceeds from nature, and something that proceeds from outside of the subject of the inclination and violence. It seems to me that what you're wanting to emphasize is that most changes that happen in the world are a result of this violent kind of inclination or inclinations that are imposed upon things that are alien to their nature.
I don't know if that's the case. I don't even know. I don't know how I would figure out what counts as most in the sphere of changes.
Yeah. Well, certainly when we make an artifact, we're imposing a violent motion upon the brain.
I think that's absolutely the case. And, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Father Raphael.
So I'm kind of wondering now if your point does come back to individuation of passive potencies. That is true. So one of the things you said was that, you know, if it's neutral or bad, but I want to focus on the neutral or the things flourishing, then it's not passive potency. So that would mean like Socrates getting a tan would not be a passive potency that he has, but at the same time, like, obviously the fact that his skin changed color is rooted in something about him. There's some fact about his skin doesn't melt when the sun shines on it, right? That's good for Socrates.
Yeah, I mean, too much sun is of course going to burn Socrates. Right?
Yeah, too much. But the fact that he's able to tan is, I think, plausibly, you know, grounded in some fact about Socrates is good for him.
Yeah,
well, sir. So, it seems like whether that counts as a passive potency is going to depend on like where you draw the line.
I think that's right. I think it's going to depend on where you think the limits are, the boundaries are, on the kinds of things that are expressive of substantial nature or not expressive of substantial nature. I mean, and that, I mean, the tan is probably neither yay nor nay.
Would your point be put better as saying, maybe it's unclear where to draw the line, but there are cases where it's clear you're way over the line?
I mean, that I would want it to be that there are central, yeah, and the central cases have to do with the good of the, or expression of the form of the substance in question. Right, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, I got it, it could happen, but that's not a potential, a potentiality of mine is not to be airborne on the way to the pavement, even though if you were sufficiently disappointed with this talk, you could make it the case that I was airborne on the way to the pavement. Yeah.
Maybe you could talk a little bit then about how this all relates to teleology. Because I see very clearly that if it comes from nature, then there's definitely a teleological condition here. But then we would also then have to account for the sort of, I guess you might say, luck of having two different causes coincide and having changes happen to them that aren't specifically of their natures, but they do happen. So, and also, with the teleological question, if someone accidentally bumps someone's coffee onto them, right, that I don't think is something exactly coming from their nature exactly, and yet the immediate response is, I am sorry. You attribute the thing to you. Or if you are sick, you say, I'm sorry, I right? So maybe you could parse some of those things or give a little bit of light on that
too. I think there's no harm in saying that I am in certain respects defective. It's like it would take most of the afternoon to recite them, but and that my defect can be in terms of how my thoughtless gesture wound up spilling coffee on you, and it can be with, you know, carrier Tay-Sachs disease. That's a way in which I am qua human being defective one, right? So I don't have much problem with that. The depth of the teleology, I think, comes from this, at least on this reading of Aristotle, which I think is consonant with Aquinas, okay? That nature is a kind of an achievement. It's not that there are all these given natures out there that are just acting, interacting, whatever. That any one of them is going to count as the actualization of a form in an important sense, and that is, I mean, a substantial form in the case of substances. That winds up being what runs all the way through, at least on this way of reading it, Aristotle's work in the Physics and also his work with Dunamis in Book 9 of the Metaphysics. Does that help?
I think it does, yeah.
Okay. Michael, I'm going to be thrown from the building now.
I have just a sort of clarification question, and then I want to follow up. Better. So just to make sure I understand, so you're, I think you would say that both, you know, real potencies, active or passive, and mere possibilities, they are both somehow grounded in or rooted in or whatever the nature of the thing that has them, right? It's just that there's something special about the ones that deserve to be called potencies.
I don't know. Possibility is a very wide category.
Right. I presume you can't take Jell-O and a squirrel and turn it into a radio.
Yeah. Even if you're a Canadian soldier in World War II.
No, but there's something about those coatballs that gives rise to the. This is not an objection.
No, I understand. No, I mean, what I understood him to mean was that we are moving through the world, making, changing, doing all kinds of things, imparting form, those sorts of things. And the cleverness of the Canadian soldiers who figured out this way, go Canada, had to do with recognizing that the materials involved in these things were such that if you rigged them in a special way, you could overcome the problem that had been caused by the Nazis cutting the telegraph lines and so find a way of patching communications armed with nothing but barbed wire, soda pop bottles, and some sticks of wood, which is kind of amazing. He was amazed. But you would want to say that you're relying on the natures of the stuff involved in figuring out how to do this. But that's your creative, formative, active engagement with stuff, not something that pre-exists in the stuff, except insofar as you've correctly identified the kind of stuff you're looking at.
Okay, so the possibility is rests on the nature somehow.
Yes.
Okay. Now, and then somebody could push and say, okay, so which are the potency wands and which are the mere possibility wands? And let's not get caught up with, hard call cases. But I'm interested in the criterion for settling which go in which. I don't know. There's a lot of questions I have. But let me just pose this as a sort of objection to see how you would. I think I'll learn something by hearing your response. What if someone said, that wasn't a possibility rather than a potency. It was just a more remote potency. You see?
Yeah, I do see. My first instinct is going to be to say that what happens when the soldiers start working on handling the fact that the lines have been cut, trying to patch communication, is that in the course of working with the stuff becomes potentially what they're working to actualize. And in this, I would treat it as roughly synonymous with Aristotle's discussion of what building contributes to building materials. Right? That they are getting worked up, and in the course of what one way of understanding the working up is as an understanding of changing the potencies, contributing potencies. In that way, it's a little like teaching or something. You're like teaching a soda pop bottle and some barbed wire and some sticks of wood how they might be, help with a radio transmission or something, where the operation of another agent, in this instance, it's not a violent operation. You're not doing it. I mean, these are not substances on this kind of view anyway. I mean, but you're not what you're doing is kind of learning the stuff to participate in a particular sort of a form in the working up of it. So it does even kind of fit the idea that potency in the proper sense is coming by nature or through practice or from some other agent. That those are the ways that it gets in you. Does that help at all?
Well, somewhat. I see there are other strands in your paper that you could have drawn on, but didn't. That's what's interesting to me. It's something you seem to be saying it's a mere possibility if you have to work the thing up. But then other times you talked about it being a mere possibility if there wasn't a teleology.
I don't see those as conflicting. I think that we're the source of the teleology in the working up part. We're the ones who are responsible for the transmission of the form in that kind of a case. In the case where you're just looking at natural objects, right, substances ideally, leave artifacts to the side, where you're just looking at natural objects, they're going to have natures. Those natures are going to count as the actualization of substantial form, which, can come in degrees and all that kind of stuff. But that's the teleology is in the nature. So it's in the stuff there. In the case of building something, we're like learning it. We're putting it in.
Now I'm seeing how these things go together. Thank you. Yes, I'm wondering why your acceptance of the natural limitations with respect to corruption as a limit condition
of your thesis. Why doesn't that really imply simply a primary and a secondary sense of potentiality here? In the sense that when normally when people would say, if one were to say, well, wine has the potential to become vinegar or whatever, if someone means that directly, you have to set contra correctly. But frequently it's simply shorthand for there is a potential principle in this wine, which can be actuated in this way.
But you wouldn't. Okay. It's not for, as I am reading Aquinas and Aristotle in this particular example, you don't assign that potency to the wine. You assign it to something else. That, you know, just like you don't assign the potency for decay, you know, even though I'm in pretty bad shape, it's like you don't assign it to Candace.
But you
assign it to something else.
It doesn't go to the wine qua wine.
Right.
But it goes to the wine in a certain way qua composite substance.
Yeah, qua composite, it can go to the stuff. And, I mean, how you're going to individuate the stuff depends on how you're going to understand the nature and whether you're going to understand wine as a substance and all kinds of other things. And those are complicated questions. And I don't think that there's an absolutely clear path between Aquinas and Aristotle on those questions. But my anxiety was over some people talking as though you could just automatically assign a potency anytime you had a change in a subject that matched with a passive, you know, an agent, a passive or active potency or some pair to the subject anytime you had a change, and that this was the way to think about potencies, especially passive potencies, given how vulnerable we are. So that it was Father Dewan, the pastoral care and teaching, I thought, was there.
So this probably has to be our last question.
So I think Bouquet, chapter 5, Metaphysics, is really important here. This is where the corpse of the vinegar example comes.
That's right.
I'm interested why you're focusing more on the role of dunamis there and less the role of proximate matter, as the paper lay.
Yeah.
So far as Aquinas, his Lectio there, says that, for instance, the goblet doesn't come from the bowl, but it comes from silver.
Yeah.
So the idea is that the silver has to be reduced to its matter and then transformed into the goblet.
Yes.
Just like in the case of the wine, it has to be reduced to its matter,
yep,
and then it can become vinegar or something of the sort. So would it be helpful at least to be thinking of the potency that you're interested in here as being directly correlated to proximate matter?
I think that there's a very strong line through Aristotle that would go like that. But there is a shift in Book 9 of the Metaphysics, and I'm partly trying to hook the dunamis in Book 9 of the Metaphysics with the larger picture of change that emerges elsewhere in the corpus, and seeing that, thinking that if you've got teleology sort of as a backbone and not expressly mentioned backbone in the account of change generally in the physics, then you can use that to help sort what's going on in the commonality between the usual sense and the useful sense of dunamis in Book 9 of the Metaphysics, where end-directedness or expressiveness winds up being common to both the usual sense and the useful sense. So that was the way I was trying to knit my bits of Aristotle together. Does that make sense?
So then I just suggest possibly that this end-directedness is also going to be what's predicted with it being proximate matter.
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be. It's going to, the sense of proximate is going to be proximate in that sense.
You've got someone in the front who says he has a very little question.
Okay, I'm so new at this, but it just came to me. So when salmon reproduce, they naturally start to deteriorate. Would you say to the salmon, dying is part of its potentiality?
No, what you would say is that the salmon dies when it dies, and it ceases to be a salmon and becomes a kind of unpleasant part of the riverbed or the surface of the water. But the reproduction, that part is critical. Does that help?
Let's give our thanks to Dr.